So my expertise here is a combination of 22 years as a journalist like Carrie, reporting on stories all over the lot of what kinds of stories, but seeing consistently that people were too afraid or not afraid enough, right? They'd be freaked out or not enough freaked out, and looked up that literature and got to understand the psychology and the human cognition and the neuroscience that explains why we aren't as smart as we think we are. Remember how I said the doctors need two doses of this talk? Sorry, but we simply are not the reasoning, cognitive, rational beings that everybody in this room thinks of themselves as, and we can't be. So I got to the Harvard School of Public Health, where I was a communications officer for some scientists who studied risk quantitatively, system-wide. And I said, that's terrific, except for down on the individual level, that's not how people respond to it. And they were kind of aware of this literature and said, we're teaching this course, do you want to teach that? And I've expanded that and now proselytize what the researchers have found about why our fears don't match the facts. And that's the fundamental message here of all, which is, and you both spoke of it, this was an emotional threat. As much as, or more, at least in the United States, as much as or more than it was a physical threat. So, you know, there were stories along the way that said, why are people so afraid of Ebola when they should be afraid of influenza? Well, and the implication in that question was, why are people being stupid? Right? I mean, you can be as benign as you want when you say that message, why are people being irrational? That word gets used. But the implication is, why are you being so dumb? The direct effect of which is for them not to trust you or listen to anything that you want to say because you're disrespecting that it is an emotional feeling. So that's the very first important message for anything that comes after Ebola. That this is supposed to be about lessons learned that are applicable next time. These outbreaks, here comes MERS, here comes whatever, right, are risks to public health. In two ways, the physical disease spread risk and the emotion risk, which has tangible health manifestations. People stressed more than a couple weeks beyond the normal levels of stress, what is called allostasis by Bruce McEwen at Rockefeller. It suppresses their immune system. It raises their blood pressure. Chronic stress is really bad for you. To say nothing of the stupid, here's my word, right? Choices that people make to, like, not fly and drive instead because they don't want that Cleveland nurse next to them on the plane, right? And that raises their risk of per mile traveled. So my first big message is risk is a feeling. Risk is not solely a physical, factual thing. Your message was full of these observations. Dealing with the risk of the vaccine and the trials and so forth involved a whole lot of understanding and showing respect for emotions, as well as just doing the tests. So when you're managing a risk, you are managing, in terms of managing people's physical health, the emotions as well as the spread of the germ. That's the first take-home message. These are the three ways that I want to emphasize this is a physical risk management challenge to all of you in the public health field. So we make harmful personal choices. We can talk about the choices that people made during Ebola. I mentioned the one about flying. That was an obvious one. There were people who were choosing not to go to their doctor's offices. There were people who were choosing not to go to that bowling alley or anywhere near that bowling alley, the guy in New York. You could go down a long list, right? People will make choices based on how they feel, not necessarily that, well, the doctor wasn't falling down dead and puking on the bowling alley lanes, therefore the bowling alleys aren't infectious. No, they weren't doing that. They were using their, I'm going to protect myself with my emotions, and making choices, behaviors. You're managing those when you're managing a public health circumstance. The second one is the harmful social choices. So how much more did America and your local public health departments have to spend on a disease that probably was never really going to be a public, spread around health threat? A lot more, right? I'm not saying that was wisely or poorly spent, but, and I could use other examples, anthrax. I've talked with Al about this. You know, were you all involved in the anthrax thing and you're sending hazmat teams for the Dunkin' Donuts powder? You know, and there's a dead bird over here. Oh my God, let's send six guys in suits and spend $30,000. So there are all kinds of social choices that are risk management for people in government that come from the emotions. And then finally, there's this chronic stress stuff. And this is really an insidious thing. And it's been very hard studied. I can give you citations if you want. But chronic stress that's more than the normal hassles of life, which you get used to, as Bruce McEwen calls allostasis, that lasts for more than a couple weeks, have turned up and down the systems that are representative of the fight or flight response that stress is. That's worry, right? So all those systems are not supposed to stay turned up or down. There's a great book I highly recommend called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. Anybody read it? Oh my God, it's hysterical, it's entertaining, and terrifically informative about the sweeping, profound negative health effects of staying more worried than you need to be. And zebras don't get ulcers because they either get eaten or get away. And then it's over. And then we don't get rid of that and our systems stay out of whack. So those are real. I go into this level of detail because you're in the public health field and you're managing public health and it looks like you're managing the germ or get your shot or wash your hands or all that sort of stuff. But stress is a huge threat to public health, and America experienced that to some degree during Ebola. And I would hazard a guess that if the studies could be done, more harm to health was done from the fear of Ebola in the United States than the disease. Fairly safe guess, right? So now I want to really depress you about how this is inescapable. The field of why we fear more or less comes from a variety of sciences. My source on this is Dr. Joseph Ledoux, L-E-D-O-U-X at NYU, The Neuroscience of How Fear Starts. And it's a longer thing than fits in this brief lecture, but what this picture depicts is the following. So the eye is seeing what could be a snake. You got that? Okay. And the information is going up to the thalamus, which is the first place that stimuli from either outside or memories inside your brain goes. Doesn't turn it into consciousness, but just relays the information to other specific regions of the brain. The slide highlights two. The one behind your forehead, called the prefrontal cortex, is where we do a lot of decision-making, purposeful, conscious, let me think this through kind of purposeful decision-making. And the center of the arrow down there is the amygdala. Let me just do this. Raise your hand if you've heard of the amygdala. Oh, you're health guys, right? Okay. Usually it's like a sprinkling of hands. It's been going up over the years. So you might know that the amygdala is where, in the brain, a lot of emotions, particularly fear, as Ledoux has studied, start. Okay? So the information goes through the optic nerve up to the thalamus, and thalamus sends it in on those yellow lines. Can you see the yellow lines? Neural pathways carrying exactly the same biochemical electrical data to the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala, where fear starts. Look at the length of the lines. Where does the information get to first in our brain? Where we think or where we fear? Pause for pregnant importance. A healthy brain is hardwired to feel first and think second. Now, as Ledoux has measured in rats, then what happens is you get more information. It carries responsible reporting that has quote-checked and fact-checked, and Dr. Schuchat's great risk communication comes along. And now the cortex has a lot of information, and those blue lines are, I've learned a lot more about how it's not airborne and all that sort of stuff. And that information, too, over time now, not just at first, gets sent to the amygdala, which says, thank you very much. But notice how many lines there are out from the amygdala to the cortex saying, let's go with our feelings here, versus how many lines there are from the cortex going to the amygdala saying, no, let's be rational. Mm-hmm. This is a very simplified way of representing what Ledoux has said in his books, and he's reviewed this slide to make sure I don't do bad injustice to his science. The second biological truth here is, and this is relevant to managing public health when people are afraid, the healthy brain is hardwired to feel more and think less over time, after you have all the facts. You're managing that during a public health crisis, and Ebola is rife with examples of how this was well or poorly done. So there are a number of characteristics also from another field of study, the psychometric paradigm, psychology, of what makes some risks feel scarier than others. And Ebola, these are the boogeyman characteristics. Okay? So a risk that's new is scarier than one with which we're familiar. The best example of that is Ebola versus influenza. Or let's do West Nile virus now versus West Nile virus when it first showed up. New is scarier. That makes sense. The amygdala is using not knowing everything it needs to know, and I haven't lived with this for years, to go, I'm going to protect myself. I don't know yet what I need to know. New is scarier, just by characteristic. If you're dealing with a public health threat that comes along and it's a new something, you got to up your game. There's going to be fear there. Dread is, here's an interesting way of demonstrating dread. Let's say you have to die tomorrow and your choice is a shark attack or heart disease. Who votes for death by shark? Nobody? Yeah, one fellow back there. Why shark? Fast. Yeah, and another hand? Fast. I gave this talk to a journalist once and he said, my obituary would be on the front page. Right? Okay, so let me just change it two ways, okay? Let's change it this way. You have to die tomorrow. You're going to die tomorrow. And your choice of how to die is either cancer or heart disease. Between those two, who votes for dying by cancer? You're all health officials. You know that that's stupid and irrational, right? You know that heart disease is more likely to kill you, right?
Yeah.
You know that, right? So what I ask you with the way I phrase the question is not about the numbers and not about the likelihood of being dead. It's the how you become dead part. Well, that's in there. And Ebola is a really sucky way to die. Pardon my non-academic language. It definitely has the dread, what they call in the literature, the dread, awfulness, boogeyman. That's one of the reasons why a lot of people don't get flu shots. You hear them say, it's not that bad. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the, oh my God, unless you, if you've ever had the flu, you know better, right? Control. You used the word control several times in your talk. I was very informed by that. The more control we feel we have over anything, driving, the less afraid we'll be. The less control we have, we're in the passenger seat, right? We're the front seat driver. What's that? That's your amygdala, literally your amygdala trying to hit an imaginary brake pedal or steer the car with your hips. I mean, you know, these are entertaining examples of real world stuff. I'm talking about rational, educated people, their physical perceptions of the world saying danger, 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 because the amygdala says, I don't have control here, it's scarier, let's do all that other dancey stuff. Well, that's way going on with a disease that can't be cured. Right? That's what we thought? That's a lot of why there's a great deal of fear of cancer. Death sentence. Right? No, but if you think that, that's a lack of control. So that disease is scarier than something you can cure me of. MERS is not going to be as scary, hopefully, for one among other reasons, because, we'll ask you that later, except we're not recording, right? So you can answer, maybe. But the nature of Ebola, a boogeyman was, can't be cured. Awful way to die. And then this last factor that's important and was relevant here is high availability. That's an academic word for saying, how much is it on my radar screen? Or how readily does it come out of memory back onto my radar screen? Okay? In fact, the first research on this was, how readily does it come up out of memory of what I already know? Because the brain knows if it comes screaming out of memory really loud and really fast, that means because it got burned in that way in the first place, and scary things do, emotional things do, I'm going to give that extra attention. We overweight. We overweight the scariness of something if it relates to or triggers the, oh yeah, I remember that. Okay? But the other form of availability is current availability, and that's where Carrie and the media and the whole world comes into play with Ebola. So we're going along with, when were the first cases in the spring? March, April? Yeah, okay. And then it starts to make news kind of because it's not us. We don't care about other people as much as we care about ourselves. That's a basic piece of psychology you probably already understand. We lament how we don't give money to the poor people and the people in Africa and all that, but that's just the human animal places its own survival first. I'm not excusing it. I'm just explaining it. Then, Dallas. And Dallas changed things with another boogeyman factor. It can happen to me. Changes everything. One case, under kind of control in the hospital. Here, Dallas, me, boing. Really, I mean, I'm sure you could date the coverage. It probably went like this, right? Now, Dallas, and it becomes me, became a big problem for the communication and illustrates some of the mistakes is too loaded a word, but some of the things that could have been handled better before Dallas. Okay? So there's that me factor. And if it can happen to me, along with some of these other characteristics, it'll be scarier than if it only threatens them. Ebola clearly teaches that. Now, that's a handy thing for you to know, because there are some diseases that you may be dealing with that can't, you know, people say, oh, it's in my community, and you can say, yeah, but your subpopulation can't be affected. That you can use these factors to communicate to people that can or can't happen to me. I designated to my partner over there that I have 5 minutes left and stuff. Watch me go over. I'm the moderator. No, I'm joking. So let's talk a little. Oh, and by the way, I wanted to add this is another emotionally important thing, and Dr. Shuckett already mentioned this, but I want to add to her definition. So trust is really super important, because if I can't protect myself from Eastern equine encephalitis spreading up through Massachusetts, if I trust Al DeMaria to do a good job, I'll be less afraid. And if I don't trust him, trust. That's all. I can't protect myself from this virus. I'll be more afraid. But trust is a little bit richer than the qualities that you mentioned. And you mentioned some classic qualities that are taught in classic risk communication that I don't think goes far enough. You mentioned empathy. And what was the other one? I forget. I took notes on what you said. You mentioned a couple, and they were spot on. I'm sorry.
I said honesty.
Honesty. But there's another one. Are you in authority? Authority. Power. So let's say you have to do an apology. You want to have your spokesperson do the apology? Because it won't be trusted because, right, they don't have the authority to apologize. You want to have the governor talking about really big, scary things, and I said this in a Boston Globe article prior to, in the middle of Ebola. Somebody in charge has to say, we're taking this seriously, because somebody down here taking it seriously isn't serious enough. So it can come from authority, and it can also come from competence. Competence. Ability to do what you're saying. Do people trust that or not? They won't particularly know. But it's a really important thing to establish competence. So, for example, in Ebola, you would have the head of the CDC, but maybe he or she, whoever it is, would say, and here's the person who really knows this stuff. And their competence will now talk to you about that specific area, because that's not my field. Or you would say something like that. And what happens is you transfer to this person, wow, he, she really knows this stuff, more trustworthy. So now let me talk about a couple of the things that I think could have been done better in Ebola. Summarize them very quickly. Let me do this first. So in March and April and May, and here comes Ebola, and it's over in Sierra Leone and so forth, and Liberia, Dr. Frieden and some other people were saying, we have to take this seriously. They were intimating it might come here, but mostly they were saying, we can control this. Yeah. Right? I mean, and this is not a surprise to you. You've heard this criticism before, and it's a gentle one. I think they did reasonably well. They could control it from being a public epidemic, but that specific emphasis wasn't added enough. And the acknowledgement that there might be a case, and it's really scary because it's new and it's you say all this stuff, wasn't done enough. So when the one case came, it stood out against what sounded like over-reassurance. Really wasn't. If you look at Dr. Frieden's remarks, they're really fine. But the media simplify them, and people on the other end of the political spectrum take advantage of them and so forth. You really have to stress humility and caution and leave yourself wiggle room. You also have to do something that also I don't think our leaders did well enough in this state, as Carrie pointed out, or nationally. You have to admit that it's scary. You can't be afraid of telling people something that might scare them. telling them that responsibly lets you frame the picture as opposed to somebody else saying it's super scary. It's also honest. That agenda that poisoned trust because they're trying to quell fear. Don't. Be honest that there might be a risk. And then when you say, but we really can keep this from being a public spread all over the place epidemic, they'll be more trusted. This is called by Peter Sandman, who has advised the CDC and many people and is a champion in the world of risk communication that I'm just a neophyte in, the fear of fear. And it was a huge mistake that cost an awful lot of public confidence in government, ergo raised stress. Okay? A couple other things. Beware your own personal agenda. I was particularly upset by Dr. Farmer and those folks who were saying, remember when the nurse came back to Newark and she had a 102-degree fever when she got off the plane and had just gotten back from Ebola land? So reasonable caution would say, let's hold you for a while and see what the next test is, right? But they hadn't thought this stuff through, so they threw her in a tent with a hamburger for 3 days, which kind of pissed her off and let her call CNN, right? Okay. But the next thing that happened was that Monday there was an editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine saying, we can't treat the nurses this way because then we won't have any medical people willing to go over and help. Well, that's true from their perspective. But from my perspective in New Jersey or Maine where this nurse went back to, I want the state to be super precautionary so she doesn't come to my community and make me sick. Now, Governors Cuomo and Christie didn't explain their poorly thought out quarantine of this nurse nearly well enough, and we didn't trust them because they're running for president and all that sort of stuff, right? But overly precautionary response to quell the public fear would not have been an inappropriate thing if they said that's what they were doing. They didn't seem confident. They didn't seem they had thought this through. But the controversy was exacerbated by the doctors saying, to hell with your fear and precaution. We're worried about nurses and doctors not going over. That made it worse. Here's another one. Remember when the nurses' unions, which are apparently fairly militant, I didn't know this at the time, but right, so that you guys do, the nurses' union said, you know, those two nurses in Texas Presbyterian, their throats were sticking out or the protocol wasn't followed. It's the health system's fault. Oh, great. That the health system where I live and in Nebraska where your centers are and so forth, wow, they don't know what they're doing. That really fomented mistrust in the competence of the system and was directly contrary to public health. So your own agenda may be fine, but there's a responsibility to it. Let me sum up because I'm 2 minutes long. Oh, stop. Oh, you even had a stoplight. Risk is a feeling. Risk is not just a fact. Risk is how we feel about the facts. Even when we have all the facts and we're super educated, it's how we feel about them. The reasons that we feel about them the way we do have been studied. They may not be the sciences with which you're familiar, but maybe your risk communication people are. I'm going to get to this last closing slide. They need to be respected. The feelings are part of the risk you're managing. They will cause behavioral problems and stress levels that are bad for people's health. Accordingly, this is my more active and holistic, I think, definition of risk communication than, quite frankly, what I see the CDC teach and a lot of states and other places teach. Risk communication sounds like what you say. I heard you doing a lot of stuff in Africa, doing, going to the chiefs, listening. Those are actions. Those are walking the walk, not just talking the talk. Proving that your agenda is sincere to show respect to people's concerns. Actions, then all the messages, that show an understanding of any sincere respect for the chief's input or the public's concerns. And the goal is not to make them do exactly what you want them to do, to get them to participate in the trial. Yes, that's your goal. But you'll do that more if you are more trusted. That's the goal. It's not just in words, it's in actions. You can know how the feelings work to some degree, plan for them, respond to them, and interact with people about risk, including your messages, more effectively to help public health. So now I hope how much time do we have, Madam kind of co-moderator?
30 minutes.
Yay, 30 minutes. Dr. Shuckett might have to leave a little bit early, but we're wide open for your question.
Mm-hmm. specialist, and this is
what do you do? Can you just like an ad of like?
I'm the chief of acute communicable disease control for Los Angeles County. So my basic problem is, and again, it's with sort of CDC in a way, that in an overabundance of caution, we've made contact diseases airborne, droplet diseases airborne. I mean, even now when you look at MERS, the WHO says one thing, the CDC says something else. So talk about disparate messages. It's really hard to recounsel those when you're trying to be the expert and you don't believe your experts. And as I said, you know, I know it's not, it's above your pay grade probably, but I mean, how can we fix that? Who
there
can
you
we
go.
Write
oh.
to?
There you go.
Thanks, Laureen. I think it's so important to have consistency, and it's also so important to have speed. And I think there's times where one institution is quicker than another. I know during so many of our emergency responses, it's New York City or LA that gets the word out first because maybe the clearance goes faster. And then we end up looking like we're contradicting each other and people don't trust us. So I think my personal feeling is the American public and some of our policymakers are extremely risk averse and that we really have expectations of zero risk when that's pretty hard to achieve. And on the other hand, when we're in a new situation and an unknown situation, beginning with caution is often wise. You know? So I think it's, to me, the key thing we have to remember is to catch everything we say in this is interim, this is based on what we know today, and it might be different tomorrow, but the best of our knowledge, this is where we're going. So I think we have to do that, but also be fast.
And at the beginning, we haven't had time to get the coordination done. That's another count that you can do. And there's one other one that I would add, and I stood up for the CDC because I kind of understood this, and I don't completely still, but you don't come into a state until the state says you can. You're not the Uber boss. We think you are.
Yeah.
And that's worth saying. That was needed in Dallas. That was necessary, I thought. And it would have put in context the different agencies and the inconsistencies a little bit. That's something that I would advise this relationship between the states and the territories and the CDC to delineate who's in charge also. Did you have anything to add? Yes, ma'am.
Kathy Gensheimer, FDA. So I understand what you're saying about the fear factor, and I agree completely with that. But I would also say that, you know, from a risk communication standpoint, when we have the science, that science is very important for us in public health to promote. And having returned from Sierra Leone somewhat recently, I was somewhat appalled to be greeted by Customs and Patrol in Atlanta wearing masks and then handing us masks to put on. When we're saying that this is not an airborne or whatever infection. So, you know, the look of consternation on fellow passenger faces when they're wondering what, who, and where they sat next to all that time really is rather unnecessary. So I think that it is on our shoulders when we have that science to really promote that effectively so that we can hopefully not create more, I think, miscommunications and confusion.
Kathy, is it?
Yes.
Thank you. You make a terrific point, and it is exactly the problem that policymakers have. When you have the evidence, but people don't go on just the evidence alone. And what I'm challenging you to do is find the middle, not the middle ground, to factor both elements in if what you want to manage is public behavior. So if there's no problem with you, let you in, you just got back from Sierra Leone, okay, and then like the next day you have a little low-grade fever because you didn't take well to flying or something, right? Storm of mistrust. There's an element of showing precaution that has something to do with all those other people on the plane going, oh God, I sat next to that lady, right? So small example, the balance between managing just based on the science being inadequate and managing way too much to the emotion being unsupported by the evidence is a huge conundrum. But what I think you can do, what government agencies can do, and I've advised some to do this, is tease the risks apart. You do a risk analysis on lots of things, and risk assessment, and all the science, the probability of a bad thing happening, the probability part in risk, right? You can do an assessment of what makes it feel bad. And you can be strategic about your precaution, your quarantine policies, etc., in recognition of the emotion part too, and there's evidence about those feelings that you can factor into overall risk management.
Just in terms of, you have the science, but how much have you explained it? Like, I felt like a turning point for me was when I got some really good explanations of the difference between airborne transmission and droplet transmission. And there was a wonderful diagram that NPR did of sort of like a drop coming out or an airborne particle going farther. And with that image and the fairly detailed explanation, I got the difference, and I would understand why you wouldn't need masks.
So I think you've done a wonderful job.
Who are you? So
I'm sorry, Gary Wheeler. I'm Chief Medical Officer in Arkansas Department of Health. So I was doing a lot of talking back then. One of the things you've illustrated beautifully is that we really have two audiences. We've got the general public, and then we have you guys. And I think it's great to have an NPR reporter where their goal is accurate information. But the rest of the media really is selling a product, and they really want crisis, and they really want other things to happen. They want to poke holes in everything.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm really interested from hearing you guys over here talk about, you know, what are your thoughts about what you want to hear from a public health officer?
Well, I went first. I have plenty to add, but I went first last then.
Okay.
What, but also from Dr. Shugart, who has had to do that and done it so successfully, about what her strategies are. Thanks.
Actually, I think Dr. Shugart.
So I have to be intelligent now. Okay. You know, I do think that acknowledging fear is really important. And I when I'm talking to the press, I do try to think about the people that are listening or watching and what where they're coming from. And I think for those of you in the audience who are have a clinical background, that's what I'm channeling when I talk to the media. I think about my patient who's coming in with and is scared, you know, doesn't know what they have and wants to listen to me. And so I try to have that mind frame when I'm starting my remarks, you know, not that it necessarily helps, but try to have that perspective. So I do think the, you know, I might not get asked back a lot because I'm not very dramatic, but I'm trying to do that one-on-one, you know, what I would want to know if this was new to me, and realize that the science has to be talked about in a pretty straightforward, simple way. So I joke that I'm a good person to talk to the press because I don't really understand all the details, so I don't convey that many details, but I do think you want to leave a lot of those details behind when you're doing the media, and try to go with where your audience is. So,
I think I would just add that the problem, the problem is not just the problem was definitely sort of the cheaper media going for audience, going for traffic. I care about traffic too, but different audience. So. But a big part of the problem is also social media, I would say, that can magnify very poor sources and really spread probably more panic than even the semi-legitimate media do. And I would suggest just taking them on directly. And, I mean, you might not want to acknowledge the ridiculous things they say, but I just wonder if maybe you should, so that then you can just directly deny them and say, you know, I understand that there are conspiracy theories going, I mean, I throw this out to you, I don't know if it's right, but there are conspiracy theories that this has gone airborne and we're not telling you. Well, the fact is, number one, we would tell you. Number two, it's not airborne, and here's everything that we know about that. So just a thought.
Lots of thoughts. First of all, you mentioned that there are two audiences. So within the media, there are multiple audiences, and that's just one of the audiences to which you were referring. And that's an important strategic thing to know, because if you talk to Richard Besser at ABC, that's not talking about to the screaming kid who's doing the live shot from CNN outside the Nebraska field where those sick people are inside. And you need to know that. And you need to know that because those bigger, louder, not louder, those more in some cases, more influential voices, right? The more seasoned, thoughtful reporters are largely not entry-level reporters, right? They're thought leaders within the media. You saw this happen in Ebola. You saw during the Ebola story, thought leaders starting to say, look at the media behaving like a bunch of babies. That was became part of the coverage. In fact, you saw it during, I use this in the teaching I do, Fox News, forgive me if that offends anybody saying that out loud. Who's their news anchor guy? I can't remember his name, but anyway, in the middle of their newscast, it was like their 6 p.m. or whatever their main newscast is, so they come on with, oh my God, 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 right? And he looked, moon suit guy's near an ambulance, oh my God. And then like 6 minutes in, he does the following. He says, all right, let's everybody just take a breath here. This is within his own newscast. It can't spread unless you get a really sick person puking and bleeding on you, effectively. We're overreacting, we're harming people, blah, 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 within his own newscast. Now, they went back to the scaring and yelling afterward, but if you find the voices that can appeal to the thought conversation in there, you've done yourself a great justice, and you have them in your state, and you all have them in your local areas. That's one thought. The second thought is, as a reporter, you want to be on the front page. I never cared about selling my product. That's wrong. It's right because I want to make my boss happy, but if you've got a good soundbite or a crying mom or a dramatic, there could be risk story, your story's going to get more attention. Your story's going to get more attention the more it has the boogeyman characteristics that I was talking about. And that's where I now directly confront the media and the blogging and the interviews that I do. Just because it's new doesn't mean it is particularly scary. Just because it might be deadly doesn't mean it's going to spread. I use this language to downplay the emotions that are seducing them to think front page. Those are two things. There's a longer thing. We have other people in mind.
Yeah, this is Rich Melkright from Connecticut. I'm the Healthcare Associated Infection Program Coordinator, and we deal with antimicrobial resistance and all that. I was talking to your equivalent in Connecticut yesterday about this. You know, one of the things that, and I think we're kind of getting at that, is, you know, that we have these little checklists we take to classes, you know, on risk communication, you know, show empathy, build trust. And I've seen, you know, I've seen some of ourselves going up there, I've probably done it too, and I can say, okay, there's checklist number one, you know, there's checklist number two. I think we have to get a sense of naturalness in some of this. I mean, I think Dr. Shukat was talking about kind of a way to kind of use our, think in our own heads, and maybe we have some advice for us, how to make sure we really project, and the emotion, we really, I think, honestly, engage that emotion, respect it, or if somebody's being a jerk, you know, we have to deal with that, you know, who's interviewing us. At the same time, we have emotions too, and how we get into an interaction in these situations where our emotions are engaged and their emotions are engaged in a positive way. It's a really challenging thing. I'm a little worried that we just, you know, think, okay, I'll say something empathetic, now I can go back to my old way of dealing with things.
This is a conversation Dr. Shukat and I were having briefly in the hall, but she had to go to her Twitter thing to tell us we're not all going to die from MERS, I think is what you're saying, right? you referred to it a little bit in your comments. This is what I advise my various organizations to do. Raise your hand if you have a partner, close friend with whom you've argued. Just raise your hand. And raise your hand if this argument goes better if you try to put yourself in their shoes and show active listening and some sincere respect for how they feel. And the rest of us are husbands, and we don't do that. Okay. So it's that, and you said it, the sincerity, the honesty. Now, you know, I've given this talk to the CEO of Monsanto, and my argument to him is, your goal is to make a lot of money. Your legal responsibility, your shareholders, to make a lot of money. You can make more money if you are legitimately, sincerely putting yourself in the shoes of the people who are pissing you off and testing your emotions. You're a leader. If what your goal is to manage public health, as frustrating as people's fears are, as the media screaming are, legitimately, honestly, sincerely, before you open your mouth to say those carefully scripted messages and tick off your boxes, if you put yourself in the shoes of the people you're really thinking about, you do it better. The BP example is the classic one. So the head of BP comes over to apologize for the oil spill, right? And he does a brilliant job with all his risk communication, which surprises his people who didn't want him to come over at all because they were afraid he would behave like a British twit. So he does really well. At the end of the half-hour conversation, he says, and maybe you remember this, I really wish I could get my life back. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Okay, if you don't remember that. That doesn't come out of your mouth if you have sincerely said what's best for BP is for me to put myself in their shoes. That's how.
Thanks.
Hi, Lorene Masfeld again.
Can we, Lorene, can we let a new voice ask first and then if there's nobody else?
Of course.
Thank you, sir.
Richard Hoffman, I'm retired state epidemiologist and chief medical officer in Colorado. And I sort of have two thoughts. Number one is for many years I had to face the press. And one comment that you made about trying to explain that CDC has to be invited in never worked for me.
Oh, okay.
Zero. And it,
well, it wasn't for you, it was for them.
Yeah.
No, but it's because it comes across as red tape bureaucracy.
Oh, okay, yeah.
All right. And the public doesn't care. It's kind of like a family medicine doc taking care of a patient with a heart attack saying to the family, we don't need a cardiologist.
That's a good caution. Whether you say it and how you would say it also matters, but good caution.
Then the other comment or question, I don't know how to phrase this, is I'm sitting here watching the news and I'm trying to figure out who's the spokesperson, Dr. Fauci or Dr. Friedman.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if you could comment on that.
And we're all moving further away from it, too. I can tell you a little bit of knowledge about that. Go ahead.
I understand there's some tension. I'm trying to understand why we don't sort of have figured out how to work that out. What the subject is, one addresses, but it seems like Dr. Fauci is frequently the primary public health spokesperson.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. I guess that, you know, over time it varies, but I think, you know, Dr. Fauci's been around since the 70s, and speaking, you know, he's terrific in the media. He came to talk at CDC a couple of years ago, and I berated him because my mother's more excited listening to him than me. And my mother kind of likes it when I'm on TV too, but he's really clear, and he's been around a long time. You know, I do think that our CDC director, Dr. Frieden, is a really good media spokesperson. He's been there 6 years. So I would say the media does go to Dr. Fauci quite often, and, you know, if I'm around 40 years from now, you know, still talking, you know, maybe I'll have the respect that he has. So I think there's a certain amount that starts with the media.
The answer to your question is when I advise organizations on this choice, who should do the talking? It's not who's in charge of which disease and so forth. It's who's most trusted. Mm-hmm. And that can come from competence, knowledge, expertise. Here's the infectious disease person, here's the person we know who goes all the way back to Walter Cronkite. So the it's a flexible answer to your question about who should do the talking depending on, in those circumstances, who is likely to be the most trusted. Maybe it needs to be the head of the organization because of the authority question. And when that switch was made, that was the factor that made the switch. There were pushbacks after this was right after the House hearing where the Republicans said the CDC is incompetent and you overpromised and all of that. I can almost quote this hearing. And that was when you started hearing from Dr. Frieden less than the more trusted Dr. Fauci because he's a more well-known commodity in the media more. The trust barometer should be the first factor for who should do the talking. And that can come from a lot of characteristics underneath.
I'm Douglas Stone. I'm from New York
City. Will you join me in thanking Dr. Shuka, who has a claim again?
I know. Very much.
And by the way, doctor, it was all recorded. Thank you. Sir.
I was wondering if you could talk to the use of humor in communicating public health messaging. I'm a student. I'm a graduate student, and I hate to say when we cover these public health issues and my peer group looks at the media, we don't look to the Fox, the MSN, we look to John Oliver. I don't know if people know Oliver.
As long as it's not The Onion or Cook Hall.
It's John Oliver.
He's awesome.
I don't know if you could talk to sort of his approach to handling this. He recently put up, and it's hit millions of views, his coverage of tobacco, his coverage of bail, his coverage of
climate change. He's done a lot.
Yeah, climate change.
And sort of that is a medium to communicate public health messaging as opposed to your truth campaign ads or any sort of more formal, what we would think of as a public health message.
I mean, John Oliver is God, right? Like, he's basically...
He's the new Daily
Show. He manages to simplify and emphasize points in a way that I've never seen the equal of. And so, I think maybe that we could draw some lessons from, or you could, as you're thinking about communication. One is that his genre is the rant, right? And There are actually quite a few opportunities to do rants in modern media. I mean, we, on our blog, we run guest posts by people. They can be funny or not. Any one of you in this room would have the authority to be a guest author because you have the credentials. And so if you, and actually on Commonwealth, we do what we call a reported rant, which is we take something that happened to us, and my kid got Lyme disease, and then we go off on it, you know, and we share the reporting that we did, but we also make it a very personal, a personal story. And so, so I think you can, I mean, you would have to have permission, obviously, to do that kind of thing. But I think, you know, he sort of epitomizes the power of storytelling in the right way, and it can be a fun challenge for you to figure out how you could do that within the parameters of your official job. But why not, right? Like
big caveat, though.
Yeah.
He's a satirist.
Yeah.
You people are in charge of the public health.
Yeah.
You can't joke around the way John Oliver does.
True.
If Tripoli is going around and you make a bunch of jokes about airplanes, World War II or something,
right?
You're the ex, whatever the hell it is, you still are with the state and her.
Right?
You can't joke around if people are really scared. Mm-hmm. It's circumstantial. So you're quoting the satirist world, but I'll quote you a CDC example. I forget what the disease was, but they made a pamphlet that was zombies are coming.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
Zombie survival.
Zombie survival ad. And NASA's used it, right? So you can have a sense of humor, yes.
Carefully.
But we look to you all to keep us safe. And if you're just clowning around or you're full of satire or you're too jocular like Dave is here when I give my talks, I mean, I've learned this lesson. I've spoken to groups where there was some really heated issue and I tried to diffuse the tension in the room with humor, and they really gave me what for, because that was disrespectful. So it's circumstantial.
Okay, thank you very much.
Hi, Isaac Benowitz. I'm an Epidemic Intelligence Service Officer at the New York City Health Department. I wanted to ask a question about target audiences. I had a good conversation recently with someone who spent a lot of years in medical editing and has talked a lot to journal editors of a number of medical journals, and they really think about who it is that they're writing for and who it is that their articles are targeting, and gave an example of one medical journal where the editor thinks, okay, my journal is really for that small town doctor in Iowa who is the only doctor in town. They sit down and read my journal once a month. They want to know something practical. So for us in public health, who should we think about channeling? Who are we talking to out there? I wanted to ask Dr. Shipkin. She left for her plane, but yeah,
it gets, from my perspective, it gets back to putting yourself in the shoes of what it is that you want to accomplish and who's on the other end of the conversation that you most want to influence. So yeah, you can use John Oliver for a certain generation, but I'm pretty sure I wouldn't tell my mother to watch him, right? Or zombie references or whatever. So the general advice that I would give is, and this goes for writing for journals, talking to the press, these meetings, whatever. Remember how at the beginning I asked you who you were? That was for a reason. You can ask yourself that question and the whole rest of whatever you're asking about goes better. It's also important to point out, you're responsible for public health, not Joe's health. And that's a challenge, because Joe's different than Mary is different than Rakim. So when you're talking, when a governor is talking to a state, the people listening aren't the state, they're Joe and Mary and Rakim. And you need to factor that into how you word things, you know, how you write your articles and how you phrase your messages. You know, I often say in talks like this and when I'm in meetings or with my friends, everybody is going to interpret these facts the way they will individually. I'm the governor of New York, and I had to look at whether to precautionarily quarantine this nurse, and we did so out of an abundance of caution. But different people, I understand, can see that different ways. The second point being an acknowledgement that there are multiple audiences out there for many of the messages you give. And the higher the emotion, the more important that is to do. We have time for one more, Lorraine. I bopped you out of line.
I was just curious. I mean, I talk to media a lot, you know, in Los Angeles, and I just want to know how you can get reporters to report the negative, not sexy aspect of a story. For example,
the don't worry part. You mean?
No. Well, yes, right. So you know about those two nurses from Dallas. What you don't say is the man who had Ebola slept with a woman for 5 days while he was sick, while he was febrile. I mean, it was mentioned in many different articles, but it was never actually emphasized about how rare it is to communicate in a you know, community setting this disease, unless you're doing healthcare or whatever, when the gentleman was really, really sick. So that never came across as a don't worry, this guy was in the community and he didn't spread it, and even the person he slept with and sweated with didn't get it. And I would say that to some media people, and it was never picked up.
So here, pardon me for butting in, but this is from my 22 years as a reporter and now a critic of the media for over-scaring people, mm-hmm. for contributing to this work, too afraid of some things. There are responsible journalists who are receptive to that, who are generally more grown up and more prominent, who you can influence and whose coverage will then influence what other people see happening. That's one. I just want to reiterate the point that I made earlier. The other one is, yes, journalists want to be on the front page, right? That's the reporter you're dealing with, isn't the editor and is selling the paper and all that sort of stuff. But they mostly don't want to get things egregiously wrong. And you can appeal to that. And you can say, in almost that many words, it would be egregiously wrong, factually inaccurate, to leave out the fact that.
Yeah. Blah, 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 blah.
Correct.
Yeah.
You can phrase it that way. And you're right in this case, right? You're telling half the story, the scary part, I know. Don't tell it, fine. But the guy slept with a woman for 5 days while he had a fever and didn't make her sick. That's got to be in your story if you want to be factually accurate. It'll move you in the direction you want to go. Will everybody get it? Will CNN get it? No. But it can't challenge them on being inaccurate. And there's one other point. Forgive me, Carrie. Most journalists, in the end of the day, don't want to hurt people by what they do. And you can make the case that if you leave that qualifying information out, you will do harm. Physical harm. People will behave different ways.
Get heart attacks.
People will, you know, not drive, not fly, whatever, you know. There is a real harm consequence to leaving this part out and being only partly factually accurate. And that will appeal to most journalists, even the kids, even the starter outer kids.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I would just add, I do agree that appealing to the journalist's desire not to cause harm or to their self-respect also is always good. But I generally think that if you want a journalist to do something specific, the best way to get them to do that is to spoon feed them the stuff that they would need. So for example, if you found, okay, you probably can't get at the Dallas woman who slept with a guy for 5 days. But what if you could find somebody else who had been in incredibly close proximity to someone with Ebola, and you said to the journalist, I'll give you this story. You know, here's this person who spent, you know, 2 weeks in a prison cell with the Ebola, someone with Ebola. But it's like, and you know that journalists are driven by narrative, by story, by news value, so you have to spoon feed them something that has that. But I think that the openness to that story would be there. It's just that your staff would need to do more work to develop the story and then hand it to the journalist who is busy.
So
So as good journalists always do, we went 2 minutes long, but we can hang around, I'm sure, but I think you need to be excused to go to whatever happens next for you, so thanks for your attention.